Well, I'd like to start by asking you when you came into social work.
I came in rather later than other people because I had not intended from the beginning to be a social worker. I went up to Oxford to read history, mm-hmm. and after 2 years, my career there was cut short by illness, and I couldn't go back. The next job I took up was one of my professors asked me to do some research work for him, which he said would take 6 months. He was the professor, Charles Whaley Singer, of history of medicine, and he had been making a history of chemistry, and he threw out alchemical manuscripts and wanted to make a complete catalogue for the British Isles of alchemical, and I was to help him to do this for 6 months.
Sorry, alchemical?
Alchemical. A-L-C-H-E-M-I-C-A-L.
I see.
You know, the part magic and part...
Oh, I see.
And part chemistry. We threw out magic. We only included experiments which had a recognized chemical change in them.
Yes.
That made it alchemy. Anyway, I did that for 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, realized I didn't want to go on the rest of my life studying medieval manuscripts. And uncertain what to do, I thought I would try teaching. And I had become interested in child psychology, partly because I belonged to a large family and already had nephews and nieces, and partly because my professor had adopted 2 children while I was working with him. And he did it very thoroughly, reading books and asking all sorts of psychological questions, which made me interested. And so I decided in the interim to go to London School of Economics to some lectures there on child psychology.
What year are we talking about?
We are talking about 1931, I think. And immediately I got caught up the idea of child guidance, which I'd never heard of, and applied for the mental health course, as it then was. And took that and qualified in 1933.
Yes. Did you do the social
science
diploma?
No, I didn't.
Sociology?
I was not a proper psychiatric social worker at all, because we were supposed to do 2 years social science.
Yes.
And I had not done that, but I'd been 2 years at university, and that gave me certain credit. And I had done 1 year's working in a children's playgroup in Paddington, after 4-year-olds. And I had also done some voluntary work in a clinic for epileptic children at the Maudsley Hospital. And Dr. Mildred Creek, one of the well-known child guidance psychiatrists, gave me a wonderful recommendation from having worked in this class with her. And so I was allowed off the first 2 years, because by that time, I was born in 1900, so I go with the years.
Yes.
And I thought, I'm really getting too old for anything. I must get started.
Yes.
And so I was allowed to go straight into the course. And although I'd had some experience of visiting for the Invalid Children's Aid Association in East London, with very poor families and family problems, I wasn't at all prepared for the acute problems which I was precipitated at the Maudsley Hospital, because we had to do 6 months adult work before we did the child guidance.
So
I had 6 months in the group there.
But you worked with the ICAA and in a playgroup before you
Before I started it, yes.
Why did you... I mean, you said, well, your professor adopted 2 children, you had lots of nephews and nieces, but, I mean, your interest in children could have taken many directions, couldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, why did you choose to work in those particular areas? I mean, that's identifying with deprivation in a way, isn't it?
Well, I wanted to help sick children. Children who've suffered and so on, that was my driving force, I think, really.
Mm-hmm.
And the first possibility was through the Invalid Children's Aid Association, who didn't ask for any qualifications.
Mm.
I could just visit for them.
Yes.
And in visiting, I was immediately struck with the enormous difference in the way families tackled their problems.
Mm.
one child, desperately ill, would be in a fairly balanced, stable family, going on as usual. A child with some comparatively minor problem,
yeah,
the whole family would break up and disasters
mm.
would follow. And I began to think that it was not so much the things that happened to you, but the way you took the things that happened to you.
Yes.
I began trying to work that out for myself, and then I began reading and
yes.
became interested in child psychology. That really was why I started
yes.
there.
So, mm-hmm.
And I regarded the adult work as something I had to get through
yes.
before I went through to the children.
Yes.
Though afterwards it stood me in good stead, because most of my work was with adults later.
Yes, yes.
And I could never have done it without that experience in the hospital. In those days, we were a group of 30
mm-hmm.
in that mm-hmm. year's course, 15 of them at the hospital at the time, and we were all women.
Mm-hmm.
And at the Maudsley Hospital, we had a wonderful tutor, Miss Ashdown,
yes.
who was very deaf and very saintly, very gentle and very sympathetic. And she was always preaching to us that we were in the hospital on sufferance,
yes.
and that it was a great privilege that women social workers were allowed to train there,
mm.
and we must be acceptable to everybody and
mm.
fulfill our work without complaints and
mm.
the rest of it. In those days, although it was the first hospital with only voluntary patients, the doors were locked, all the wards were locked,
yes.
and the students weren't allowed keys, and if we
mm.
went in to interview a patient, we'd be locked into a side room with the patient,
that's
and
it.
No hope of coming out again until the nurse remembered that she'd locked us in there. And say this to a nervous student, perhaps quite terrified, particularly as one of the first times I went into a locked ward, a patient had got a knife and had attacked a nurse
mm.
who had grasped the knife and had all the tendons of her finger cut by the knife.
Mm.
We were all told how heroic this was of the nurse. And I thought to myself, is that what we've got to do? See somebody brandishing a knife. So,
mm.
And as I say, I could remember the first time I was sent out on a visit, this gentle Miss Ashdown had been telling us about how we would have to visit depressed people and try to help them. And there came a call, somebody came in to say the visit was urgently required. Miss Ashdown looked round and, seeing me, one of the oldest, suggested that I should go. And I was told it was a patient who had attempted suicide with her newborn baby, gassed herself. The baby had died. She'd come into hospital and was said to be recovered and had been sent home again. And the landlady rang up to say that she appeared distressed and depressed. She'd suggested to her to come to hospital. She wouldn't come. So would somebody go and see her? So I went there, quite trembling, quite unaware of what I could do or couldn't do. And when I came there was a distraught young woman. And the first thing I noticed was that she had a gas kettle. And in those days they used to have a long rubber pipe leading from the gas that you plugged onto the kettle and then turned the gas
mm.
on. And she'd taken the kettle off and the gas tube was lying on the floor there. And as I came in, she was sharpening a carving knife on the table, the wooden table, backwards and forwards.
Mm.
And in the room was the empty cot, the empty pram. However, she was, you know, a little bit in touch. I asked for a cup of tea. I thought, if anything, to get that kettle put back on.
Yes.
And she made me a cup of tea and then began to talk a little bit and talk about her distress. And she came back to the hospital with me. Saw her doctor. So that, you know, the lands
mm.
were chained,
yes.
and so one began to learn.
Yes, yes.
But,
what was the coursework like? What sort of things were discussed in seminars, and what sort of things did students argue about in those days?
In the casework seminars with Miss Ashdown,
mm.
Very much the kind of approach, and we were very much taken up with the idea of hypocrisy.
Yes.
There were certain of the tutors and lecturers who said you must smile as if nothing had happened if they're rude to you and so on,
mm.
and you must accept whatever is said. And the some of us, myself included, passionately felt this was wrong,
yes.
that honesty was the only way in which you could deal with the patient.
Mm.
And if they had to go into mental hospital, you had to say so, and not that you were taking them out to tea or something.
Yes.
Because in those days, people were still doing this persuasive business and lecturing on it and saying it was the right thing to do.
Pretending you're going to take some
cup
of tea rather than
Yes. And this is one of the things that we discussed again and again, and people fighting the last ditch, saying, well, you needn't say everything that you know, you could just tell part of the truths and so on and so forth.
Hmm.
We were very much admitted into the training of the doctors at the hospital in those days. We went round the wards with them, and when the registrars were interviewing new patients, very often they would invite us in and we would sit with them and have discussion, so on and so forth, which again was very valuable. And as you know, that was to begin with 2 days a week, while we had 3 days a week in the LSE, and then the other way around, 3 days in fact, 2 days. And that fitted in very well with Miss Clement Brown's lectures in Hatfield and the others.
Was there formal teaching of interviewing techniques?
No, I would not call it formal.
No.
It was much more on a practical line. You must go and see this patient to persuade them to come into hospital. And then you must recount when you came back what happened, how you got on, and why you think they refused, and why the husband didn't come in, and so on. It was that sort of teaching rather than any background theory. It was only much later that I began reading the American books.
Yes. But after you left the course, you mean?
Yes.
Yes.
But one exciting thing happened to me at LSE, which seemed to me like a railway station after an Oxford college, was that Lancelot Hogben was lecturing on experimental biology. And one of my student friends there, not on our course, said to me, why don't you come? It's absolutely fascinating. It's first rate, man's a genius. And so I slipped into the back of the course there, and we did exciting experiments with frogs and decelerated cats and so on. But what was so exciting about it was, I remember the first lecture I went to, he started off by saying, what is life? How can you define life?
Yes.
We were all striving at this and so on. And the same way, all the way through with the instinctive responses and so on, how did we define them? What did we think they meant? What was their purpose? What purpose had they served in evolution and so on? Most exciting and stimulating. And at the first time, as I came out, he said to me, you don't belong to my class, do you? And I said, no, but may I come? He said, yes, if you want to. And the same things were the most exciting of the lectures that I went to.
To what extent during the period we're talking about now, there were a lot of social surveys being published from in London, Merseyside, Bristol, York, and so on, which sort of showed the effects of the depression on social conditions, chronic unemployment, health, so on and so on. To what extent did that impinge on the sort of discussions and on the mental health course at that time?
It certainly impinged, but it didn't overwhelm, and it was not taken up as a political issue much, quite different from the students now.
Yes.
We felt this enormous revelation we'd had that it was how people took things, not what happened to them, that mattered.
Yes.
You could help them to take them satisfactorily. And this was the thing that we worked at and we were inspired by, and of course we knew that some were unemployed and all the rest of it. And of course it was before National Health Service.
Yes, yes.
We still had mothers who wouldn't go to the doctor because they couldn't afford it, while the man got covered by his insurance.
Yes.
And agonizing things like that. And we worked away at the Penny a Day Hospital Saving Association, Penny a Week was it, trying to get people to prepare for illness and so on. With remarkable success.
Yes.
But, we were much more involved in the personal and within our own personal problems and the use of personal relationship. Those were the new things that we were struggling to master and to put into place. So that I qualified in 1933, and Betty Irvin and I were the first two to get distinctions. Which was very exciting because the mental health course had only been going for 4 years.
Yes.
And I think it was rather a feather in their cap, you know, that they had two distinctions in that year. So great celebrations over that. And then Dr. William Moody took me back onto the staff of his clinic, and I'd done my child guidance training there. And he was the most...
Which clinic was that?
The Islington one, Canonbury.
Canonbury
Place.
Yes.
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 Dr. William Moody was the most sympathetic, encouraging, far with your figure.
Yes.
And with a very gentle way, able to run a large clinic with three different teams in it, of different persuasions.
Oh, yes.
And,
yes.
And he was eclectic himself, and he would move us from one team to the other. I worked with the Freudian for a bit, and the Jungian for a bit, and so on.
Yes.
And there were all sorts of warring elements, as there always are, and people being analysed and all the rest of it. But he was always calm and gentle and fatherly. And I remember going to him at an early stage with some frightful problem that I'd struggled with, and it all fallen to pieces. And he's listening very gently and then saying, oh, well, good work is never wasted. You know, those words have often come to me in afterlife.
Yes.
So that I remember that. He just had that knack of
yes.
holding you up when you were falling down.
Can you describe a bit more about the atmosphere of that? You say there were three different teams with
yes.
three different theoretical
yes.
orientations.
Yes.
And I wonder if you can explain a little more about that.
Well, Dr. William Patterson Brown was the Freudian, and he had attached to him PSW, a psychologist. I can't remember how big the team was altogether. And he ran the case discussions,
mm-hmm.
and the social worker had allocated the cases, but when we came to him with all problems and so on,
mm-hmm.
and he saw most of the children himself. He was a born teacher, and ideas which at that time were considered very new. One of them, running a play group for not adolescent but the pubertal boys
yes.
in the garden, climbing trees and throwing
mm-hmm.
things about and so on. And he encouraged all of us to have our own play groups of different ages.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And encouraged me to take a 4-year-old group, as I had run 4-year-olds before, and so on. And he used those groups for teaching what had happened in the groups, and reported back and tried different children, different groups and different permutations. And afterwards, I was on the staff there from 34 to 37. He was made director of the new Wilston Child Guidance Clinic that was just opened.
Yes.
And he took me with him there.
Yes.
And there we had the Institute of Education teachers in training
yes.
were sent to him as students.
Right.
And it was most illuminating. His
yes.
discussions and letting some of them come to the playgroup and discussing afterwards how it differed from teaching and
yes.
relationship and so on and so forth.
Yes.
Fascinating. And he wrote wonderful reports. He believed in sending illuminating reports to the head teachers of the school
yes.
in the centre,
yes.
and that they should be really teaching documents
mm-hmm.
and was ready to discuss them
yes.
and so on afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'd only been there a little over a year when the war broke out.
Yes.
And the clinic was closed in a week.
Yes.
And
well,
he was in the Air Force.
Yes. Well, before we come on to
yes.
the war, I wonder if I could just go back to
yes.
that Canonbury clinic with
yes.
its three teams.
Oh, yes, I haven't done any of the others.
And, I just wondered the way in which the differences showed themselves in either discussion or work.
Well, Michael Fordham was the Jungian.
Yes.
And he was very Jungian at the time, taken up with mandalas and all the rest of it. I mean, he kept referring us to Jung's teaching and Jung's books
mm.
and so on. We used rather to laugh about that, and always saying the answer was the mandala.
Yes.
And but he was, as I say, also an interesting, exciting teacher, and did produce some remarkable drawings from his children and so on. He was there. And then John Bowlby was there. When I was there, he came as one
yes.
of the Zoom teachers. And at that time, the child psychiatrist did 6 months in a child guidance clinic.
Yes.
And they did it very much alongside the social workers in training.
Mm-hmm.
They shared the seminars
yes.
and they shared the teaching. And it seems to me that that's the only way for making a really cohesive team.
Yes.
We understood
yes.
each other, we respected each other's approach and work.
Yes.
And we really were close team. And when I hear now all the discussions about autonomy and who does what and the child psychiatrist and so on, I say it's because you haven't trained together. You don't know each other. You don't know what you can do and what you can't do.
Yes.
I'm sure they'll have to come back to that if they're going to go on with child guidance. Specialisation and team training together.
Who actually financed the clinic?
The American Commonwealth Fund.
Yes.
Financed the course at NSE too.
Yes.
We should never have got the course if they hadn't offered to pay for it.
That was just for a couple of years though, wasn't it? What happened after that? Who took on the clinic once the Commonwealth Fund grant was withdrawn?
Well, they then started getting payment from the local authority.
Oh.
At first it was all free.
Yes.
But they began, and there were great discussions going on. The OCC in those days offered to pay so much per head of the children seen there.
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten what it was, £25 or something, and there was a great deal of scorn that the OCC was meaner than any of the smaller local authorities. And then they tried to raise money with grants and appealing to foundations and so on. It was always an anxiety.
Mm.
And the American Commonwealth Fund continued to, it was a gradually diminishing income that they sent. And they send over one of their directors every year, who was, and I can give you a photograph, show you a photograph of her, I think, who was a remarkable woman. And it was a great support for discussing policy and strategy and all the rest of it, because she'd been through it all in the States. Very sympathetic and understanding. And the Child Guidance Council had been formed here with the object of collecting money and financing. And helping to run the interclinic conference, because it was felt very important to keep this new idea of the team working together in front of the public and working together not only in a clinic but right throughout the country. And so the interclinic conference was run first every 2 years and then every year.
Yes.
Which was no press allowed, clinical discussion, confidential. And representatives of the different disciplines and discussions and discussion groups. And that went on right until the war and started again, I think, in 47. Got going again.
Yes.
And you may have heard that the NEMH, which, as you know, was formed from the three bodies when the Child Guidance Council was absorbed into the NEMH in 1946.
Yes.
They took over the functions of the Child
yes.
Guidance Council, one of them being to run the interclinic conference.
Yes.
I was on the staff then and was there until 1965, running that conference. And then, after I left, there was nobody enthusiastic about it.
Yes.
And it gradually, it was handed over to administration. They put administration officers to speak at the conference. The clinical people wouldn't go.
Yes.
And it faded away. And then, 3 years ago, the clinic teams demanded it should be revived, and we have now revived it, and we've just formed a Child Guidance Trust with the idea of promoting it. Very precarious, no money, and whether that will survive, I don't know.
Were you actually involved in the amalgamation of the three organisations that created the NAMH? Were you one of the people involved in that?
Well, in a junior way, I was some... I have to explain. You've probably heard about the aftercare of psychiatric casualties.
Yes.
You see, I was employed by Willesden right up to the war, and then we'd close with 1 week's notice, and we all volunteered the Ministry of Health to do what they wanted with us.
Mm.
And the Ministry of Health sent me up to Northampton with the evacuated children, as welfare officer to them, where we had a large number. And I stayed there until 1944. And again, fate intervened, because although I had enormous number of problems with the children, and I started a child guidance clinic there, a very sympathetic psychiatrist from the local mental hospital. I demanded a psychologist, and the Ministry of Health sent me one day a week.
Yes.
We managed to keep going on that. And I was a social worker, although we were. We had a clinic team. And then Dunkirk.
Yes.
And the soldiers sent back from Dunkirk were sent immediately out of London so they wouldn't have another night of bombing.
Yes.
And they came up to Northampton, exhausted at the end of their tether.
Sorry, so that the soldiers wouldn't be bombed? Or
so the soldiers wouldn't be bombed,
yeah.
Yes, because they were, most of them, on the verge of breakdown.
Yes.
And without sleep for days.
Yes.
When they got out of the train at Northampton, a lot of them slumped on the platform, just passed out. And we billeted them in Northampton,
yes,
in families. And as I've been billeting the children, I was in on that. And then all the local people knew me, so they came to me. This man is ill, and this man is crying all the time, and
yes,
what can we do, what can we do? And one couldn't help it, one became an adult,
yes,
centre as well. And I had to report every month to the Ministry of Health of what cases I'd taken on.
Yes.
And I wrote to them saying, I can't help it, I must serve these people as best I can. And, well, in 1942, there was an official after care of psychiatric casualties scheme.
Yes.
And they asked me to go down to take over the South East region, Kent, Surrey and Sussex. So that I came into adult work.
Yes.
Willy-nilly, it just happened.
Yes.
Before I leave Northampton, I learned a lot of things there. One of them was working with people who were not trained and not members of the team.
Mm.
The billeting officers were mostly the old education officers.
Yes.
And in fact, they all were, I think. And I used to have regular meetings with them.
Mm.
They had found the billets, and they actually took the children,
yes,
and placed them there.
By education officer, you mean?
Truancy,
yes,
officers.
Yes,
were.
Education welfare officers.
Well, welfare, yes, they now
the
call
school
them.
The school board man.
The school board man, that's who it was. And
yes,
they were splendid chaps, many of them.
Yes.
And they wholeheartedly came into the scheme, and they haunted my office. They came round saying, this child hasn't settled down, and do you know, we've put him in a very bad home, and things like that. They knew everybody. They were absolutely invaluable.
Yes.
And, why was I talking about them?
Northampton.
Yes, you see, I learned to work with them.
Yes.
And then we started running hostels. First, for some children were unbilitable. They were so destructive and disturbed,
mm,
nobody could take them.
Yes.
And so we opened a hostel for boys and girls. And that ran pretty well. And then I had to open one for skin infections, scabies particularly, and nits, which couldn't be controlled. Children had got really infested with nits and got sores. And what else? And bedwetting.
Mm.
Those are the ones we started with for the children. Excuse me.
Okay.
Well, just talking about the hostels, I know, mustn't dwell on them. But by the end, I was running 13 hostels for adults as well as children.
Yes.
We were asked to take the, I know why I was telling this bit, we were asked to take women for their confinement so they shouldn't have them under the bombs.
Mm.
And so every Friday we had a coach load of women said to be in their last month of pregnancy came up, and we received them in a school hall, the health visitors and I tried to sort out their social problems and what sort of people they would be to. And the health visitors would discuss their health side. And then the billeting officers were there to, we worked with them as to what sort of place would be suitable. But some of them were unbilitable.
Yes.
And we soon had three hostels, two for the women about to have their babies and one for those who'd had their babies and nowhere to go when they were born.
Yes.
And we had those. And then we were also asked to take boys, heart cases, who were unable to live in ordinary billets and so on. We had to have a hospital for them, severe heart cases. So that in the end there were 13 hostels. And again, I was working very closely with the health visitors there. Every Friday we had this meeting with the new influx in.
Mm-hmm.
And constantly during the week they would drop in with some problem, or I would call on them with some problem.
Yeah.
So that this broadened my background very much, because we had been rather precious in the early days of child guidance, saying,
yes,
you know, this is confidential, nobody knows what we're talking about, you have to learn all about it before you can understand, and so on. So that when I came down to work from Tunbridge Wells, the aftercare scheme, I had to recruit what staff I could,
mm,
because we had a large caseload there. And I had retired nurses, one actress who was an excellent,
yes,
person, and others who later became psychiatric social workers, several,
mm,
of them went on to train. And I think that my previous experience of working with people were not, they didn't share the same training, but somehow,
yes,
sharing it with them was useful. And I...
So you had to offer them a form of in-service training while
yes,
they were doing the
yes,
job?
Yes, with weekly interviews,
yes.
Individually and in groups.
Yes.
And with carefully measuring the amount of responsibility they could take and so on. Well, that has convinced me more and more that there should be mixed teams, and that we should have the core of the child guidance specialist training team, but its function should be to spread out its teaching into the schools and amongst the health visitors and so on. And afterwards, I did a lot of health visitor lecturing. And
yes.
Became the Royal Society of Health made me their social work representative, and
yes.
every year at their annual conference,
yes.
I presented a social work program.
Yes.
For several years, so 10 years, I suppose. So that through the chances of my life, I've been made to spread out more, but I believe it's right.
Yes.
I believe it's the right way to train.
Yes, going back in time a little, but
yes.
linking on with what you're saying, were you involved in the move to set up the British Federation of Social Workers just before the war?
No. I was an enthusiastic, certainly a firm member of the Association of Psychiatric Social Workers,
yes.
and used to go to their Saturday afternoon meetings where we discussed
yes.
our common problems, and found these extremely useful and stimulating.
Yes.
Enjoyed that. Very much.
Yes.
I was very reluctant for them to lose their identity by sinking into the
yes.
British Federation.
Yes.
British Association of Social Workers.
Yes. 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 I'm not.
I'm not talking about that.
No. I'm talking about the pre-war British Federation.
No, I wasn't.
No,
I wasn't involved in that. I don't think I was interested in that.
Yes. So.
But I was never very keen about that because of
no.
the association. And you've probably heard that there's a group of old stagers who had a meeting every year in the Maudsley until last year, of the Association of Psychiatric Social Workers meeting.
I heard that there
yes.
was an that they met.
Yes.
I didn't know it had stopped.
Well, Margaret Eaton, who organised it, died a few months ago,
mm.
and that stopped it for this year.
Mm.
Whether anybody will revive it, I don't know. They let it a day about the arranging of memorial service for and so on.
Mm.
She was the moving spirit of the...
Yes.
She was the Maudsley senior social worker.
Yes.
So all that had made her in there.
So you worked with the emergency committee throughout the war, did you?
Yes. You see, I first was working with the evacuees and running the child guidance side to it. Then the Dunkirk brought in the adults
mm.
and we were working
mm.
there. And then I came in 1942 to Tunbridge Wells
mm.
to start an office there
mm.
and to collect a team and to... And we tried to keep up a standard of visiting a patient within a week of their being sent home.
Yes.
And we kept that up pretty well.
Yes.
They were all visited before they left hospital, and I did that. I visited all the hospitals, saw the medical notes, talked to the staff and talked to the patient,
yes.
and asked them what it was going to be like when they went home, what they were looking forward to.
Mm.
It was discharged people, not going back to the army. And then wrote up that report immediately. A copy went to the Ministry of Health, and a copy went to the region where the patient was going to go.
Yes.
It might not be your own region. And then we tried to do this visiting within
yes.
a week and following up and interchanging. And we had this enormous file of documents, about 30,000 cases.
Yes. Did you have a car to get around? Or?
I didn't have a car of my own, but the Ministry provided a driver and a car for me when I wanted one,
mm.
particularly because they asked me to do another job, and that was to visit all the... There were 30 residential nurseries for children in the area. They had evacuated all the day nurseries from London,
mm-hmm.
and they were scattered about in country houses, one at Langbourne.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I had to go around and visit them and send in a confidential report to the Ministry, which again was very valuable and interesting work. I'd had my own hostel, so that I knew something about running hostels,
yes.
and what to look for and what to ask for. I felt it essential to keep the confidence of the matron or master.
Mm-hmm.
So I told them what I was going to say and discussed it with them. I didn't actually show them the book, but I discussed it with them, and which was a great help, so that I was able to go again and visit them again. There were one or two that was disastrous and had to be closed. And there was a great lack of understanding of the needs of children and the sense of play and a close relationship with an adult. So there was a great, they had a hospital nurse in charge of each hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a great stress on cleanliness and hygiene and so on.
Yes.
And very sad to find 30 children aged 2 in one room, one adult.
Yes.
And the children rushing at you when you came in at the door.
Yes.
And the toys all locked away in cupboards in case they spoiled them. So I was so worried about these locked away toys that with a colleague, another psychiatric social worker, we started what we called a circus of devising toys from rubbish, empty cartons and egg boxes and things like that. And we made a whole series of easily made toys.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went round the hostels displaying them and suggesting to the staff that they should make them and the children could play with them and let them tear them to pieces. It didn't matter.
Yes.
Which was great fun. Mrs. Goldschmidt and I. Have you met her? She afterwards went into the ministry and was...
Yes. Wasn't she something to do... Something to do with education in social work in schools.
Yes, yes, I think so.
Yes.
She drifted away from the child guidance field. And,
yes.
I didn't see her much afterwards, except over filmmaking when they made some films showing what children needed in play and so on. We met over that.
So.
But I didn't think much of the films.
Actually, you were lobbying for. While you were doing your job, you were also sort of like a pressure group or a lobbyist for better care for children.
Yes, yes, we were, for more human care for children. And I think that...
Can you remember any anecdotes from that time? And
I was going to say, I think that dated from my play group in Paddington, that I was so appalled at the lack of contact with adults and the children, the four-year-olds, that my own family and nephews and nieces, as soon as they saw you, would look up and would run to you.
Yes.
But these children would huddle in corners and so on. And I tried to introduce them to life. We played in a concrete playground, bringing up tadpoles from the country and things like that.
Mm.
And I got somebody to present them with a rabbit. And when I wasn't there, mercifully, the rabbit was torn to pieces, killed by the children by mistake. All grabbing at it. Didn't realise it. Yes, it was literally pulled limb from limb by these little, I suppose people would call them deprived children now, but there they were.
Yes.
And terribly difficult. A child fell down and grazed its knees. You couldn't help picking it up and hugging it. And the other children would rush to you, wanting the same thing, and you couldn't give it to them all. 30 children.
Mm.
There were only two of us on duty.
How did you set about trying to get the nurses and so on to change the way, or the ministry to change provision or change the care of the children?
In these hospitals that we visited, well, say the one way was the introduction of the actual toys and talking with the staff and asking them about problems with the children, and then suggesting that perhaps this child needed more.
Were they receptive to what
you
had to say?
Yes, many of them were. I remember at Glyndebourne, that was one where they had this large number of children, beautifully hygienic, but it seemed to me to be no human contact. And the nurse said to me, the matron said, little children, all they want is to be kept warm and fed. They're not old enough to recognize people and so on. And we went out, it was a summer day, and we went out in the field, and the children were taken out and into the garden. And I said, there was a field the other side, and I said, oh, couldn't we go into the field? They could run races and so on, some of the older children. And she said, They'd run away, they'd get lost. We can't go in there, it must be here, there's a wall around it. And I said, I don't think they would. Let's try, I'll help you. So we went into the field, and the children immediately rushed away like a snack. Oh, goodness, they've gone. I'm undone. But after a bit, after they got as far as they dared, they turned round and they came running back.
Yes.
And I said to the matron, there, I told you about the invisible elastic of these children. I said, they're all attached to human beings by invisible elastic. There it is, you saw it pulling them back. And she was astounded, because
yes.
It really it was most dramatic.
Yes.
How they went just that far and then came running back.
Were those ideas that you'd worked out for yourself, or were they part and parcel of your training course?
Both really. Part and parcel of my training course and things that I've
That was a very telling metaphor. I've never heard that before.
Yes.
They're tied to you by invisible elastic.
I think I heard that from, I don't know if it was Patterson Brown, I don't think I made that up myself, though the idea was very familiar, because I'd seen with my own many nieces and nephews.
Yes.
But the...
ideas, and you were just going to say how where they came
from.
And
there from. Again, you see, my way of working was always through people, through human relationships, through discussing with them. And I've never forgotten my lecturing to the health visitors, asking them to bring problems. I said, any of you have had a difficulty in your work about a child relationship with a child, let's bring it, let's discuss it. You're tired of hearing about mine. And some of them, most indignantly, said, but we don't have any problems with our children. We're trained to look after them. And I, years later, running a course for hostel staff, residential course, after we'd met for a little, I suggested that they should bring up the problems that they wanted to discuss. And again, this withdrawing. But we don't have problems. We're the matron, the warden. That's why we were appointed. We wouldn't be worth our jobs if we had problems. So, it was.
So
then, I say, I was much more concerned with personal relationships always. But then, the aftercare scheme, as you know, came to an end with the Act, when the Act came into force. The local authorities had the power to carry out the in my area, I had Kent, Surrey, East Sussex and West Sussex. And Kent and East Sussex and West Sussex asked me to stay on until they got adjusted.
Yes.
So I went on working there, gradually doing less and training in the staff who were taking over until 1952.
So who was your employer then at that time?
Each local authority.
I see, it's like a joint appointment.
Yes, a joint appointment. And the NAMH had asked me to come on their staff as soon as I was free. So I started doing 2 days a week in London and 3 days in Oakland. So I gradually weaned to London, where they had kept on their aftercare department.
Yes.
They didn't mean to. Again, they thought the local authorities would take it over.
Yes.
But they couldn't, as they still can't. Requests come in all the time there.
Yes.
And at that time, we had a full team of psychiatric social workers, and we offered an interview to anybody who wanted it. The only thing we couldn't do was visiting. But we offered an interview and discouraged long telephone calls. And they tried to refer people to the appropriate agency or treatment, whatever was required, or to help them ourselves. And we tried to do it as a short term, which again was a whole new way of working that we had to learn.
Yes.
How to be effective short term, and how to extricate yourself in a helpful way. Some patients can linger on.
As you accumulated all this experience, did you write about it?
Yeah, I've been very bad about writing. Always found it difficult. Partly because I've always gone on doing odds and ends.
Yes.
And although I retired in 1965, perhaps the things have crowded in on me. I was immediately asked to run the World Federation for Mental Health International Congress in London. Took 2 years doing that, and that was in 68. And then I was asked to run a conference for prevention of suicide, which took another year.
Yes.
And then another one the year after that.
Yes.
And then I got taken up by the Save the Children Fund. I'm still on the overseas committee. Then in 78, well, it was 77 we started organizing this interclinic conference. 79 we did it again. 80 here we are doing it once more, so that it's very difficult to get extricated from things that happen. I've left out a whole series of things, such as the Young Husband Committee, which I served on, again, with enormous interest, because it was there we were discussing the theory of training and the possibilities.
Yes.
And then I served on the Council for Training Social Work, and also the National Institute for Social Work Training.
Yes.
So, the administrative and training sides. And during the war, I'd also been on the committee for UNRWA.
Yes.
So those other sides came my way. I say they just happened to me. I always say that I only once applied for a job in my life, and that was refused. Other things, you know, there's suddenly a demand, it's got to be done, and you find yourself doing it. Though long term, I would never have imagined I was going to.
You've always been asked if you will do it.
Yes.
A job,
yes.
Rather than had to apply for any job.
Yes. Or else I found myself doing it and had to ask for authorization.
Yes.
Might be that way around, as it was during the war.
Yes. So you, once your period with the those southeastern counties came to an end, you were full time with NAMH.
Yes. Yes.
And your work there was what promoted running.
I was deputy director.
Yes.
And I was I don't know what they called it. There's some awful title, general secretary or something of the social services department.
Yes.
And I had two committees there. The social services one ran various schools and hospitals and social work problems, and the clinical services one, which combined child and adult clinics. And those were really very effective committees, with experts serving on them, and people regarding it really as an honour to serve on.